Six Music.
BBC Radio, Six Music Documentaries.
I'm Matt Everett and welcome to The First Time on Six Music. This is the series where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and look at the seminal first musical moments that shape their lives and their careers. Today we welcome to the show a singer and songwriter who creates music that takes inspiration from the classic traditional songbook, cabaret and opera, but frames it in an emotional honesty and romantic flair that feels totally modern. My guest on The First Time this week is Rufus Wainwright. Here Rufus discusses the realities of being born into folk music royalty. He's the son of Loudon Wainwright III and the late Kate McGarrigle, and a childhood totally surrounded by music. We cover his love of 80s chart pop and a passion for Nina Simone, Maria Callas and Judy Garland. We also look at his own work, the making of his acclaimed 1998 debut, his experience playing the prestigious Carnegie Hall, and how his intense relationship with his parents affected his work. But I started by asking Rufus, as I do with all my guests, when was he first aware of music?
Can I remember that? I actually can't. You know, my first crib was a guitar case, technically, because my mother She had me in a hospital during that period of time in the 70s, which is what people usually did, unlike today where you can have a kid anywhere. Anyways, but we were driving home from the hospital, apparently, and my dad was in the studio. And they dropped by the studio, and they got there and realized that there was no crib, so they put me in a guitar case. So it started with that. There's a wonderful picture of it as well that exists. And so I can't really pinpoint the exact first memory. I will say that it definitely involved probably my mother singing to me as a child, very, very dark and scary and politically incorrect nursery rhymes.
Seriously, is that true?
Yeah, you know, things about murder and, you know, losing your child and the vow shall break and so forth. So scaring me. Music scaring me, that's what I remember.
What kind of songs? Can you remember any of them?
Well, there's one, Go Tell Aunt Rhody.
Yeah.
The Old Grey Goose is Dead, Now She's in the Woodshed. You know, things like that. The Doctor Says She's Dead. That kind of stuff.
They don't write nursery rhymes like that anymore.
No, they don't.
Go tell Aunt Rhody, go tell Aunt Rhody, go tell Aunt Rhody, the Old Grey Goose is dead. One she's been saving, one she's been saving, one she's been saving to make her feather bed. Go tell Aunt Rhody, go tell Aunt Rhody, go tell Aunt Rhody, the Old Grey Goose is dead.
What about the first time you heard music on the radio? And because that's a different kind of relationship,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, no, and the radio is a little more, I'm more cognizant of that. I think my early memories of the radio were when I would pretend to be sick. In primary school, I would sort of feign illness and pretend that I had this horrible, you know, disease and couldn't go to school that day, and just because I didn't want to, you know, get up in the morning. And my mom would kind of buy it occasionally. Basically, I don't think she believed me, but she just didn't want to fight it that particular morning. And I would end up staying in bed. She'd be like, okay, well, you got to stay in bed all day then. And I would, and at first it was the most wonderful concept. And then, you know, 3 hours later, I would see all these kids kind of playing out in the streets in the sun, and I'd be pretending to be sick in bed, and I'd listen to the radio. And that was sort of my solace and my, you know, fake illness. But I believe it was people like the Thompson Twins were a big early sort of obsession of mine, that band. Lots Hold of, Me Now, I remember. Yeah.
That's a good song.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That was, I don't know, that for some reason that album and that that song's particularly really, really grabbed me at that age.
Yes.
The Eurythmics. I think I was more of a, you know, more sexually ambiguous off the bat.
What about the first piece of music that you owned that was yours? You went out and
specifically, it was Men Without Hats, Safety Dance. Yeah, and that was a big deal at the time because they were from Montreal.
Oh.
And I was brought up in Montreal. So the concept of them being, you know, number one artists and being from our hometown was a huge deal. So.
Was that a kind of, if they can do it?
Yeah, No, if they can do it, only I can also do it.
We can dance if we want to. We can leave your friends behind. Cause your friends don't dance, and if they don't dance, well, they're no friends of mine. See, we can go where we want to. Places they will never find. And we can act like we come from out of this world, leave the real one far behind. We can dance.
What do you say?
A question that I often ask in these interviews is, well, when was the moment that you realized that music would be a path that you could take? But I guess with
that was never a question.
It was always...
No, apparently my mother claims, she claimed, sadly she's no longer with us, but the great Kate McGarrigle, but she claimed that at 6 months I could modulate. She would sing Old MacDonald and I would sing E-I-E-I-O, and then she would go up a half tone and I would go E-I-E-I-O at 6 months, which I don't believe. It's possible to but having it, had a child now. It's she was lying.
But it's a nice story.
Yes.
Okay, first album then, because that's when you buy a whole record and you get involved with, it means something to you in a different kind of way. What was that one?
I will say an album that I remember distinctly listening to often and the whole way through was the soundtrack to Chariots of Fire.
I've just got images of you running really slowly
what's
now.
What's interesting, though, is that I would listen to it sped up. Na, 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 na. I would speed it up and listen to it and kind of race around, you know, with my head exploding. some albums I remember enjoying more that way. Oh, the other one was Oliver. I would listen to sped up. The musical Oliver. Oliver.
As fast as possible.
Yeah, as fast. And I only listened to it sped up. It was interesting.
Nina Simone is someone that means a lot to you. When you started playing piano, was that like an immediate influence?
Yeah, well, I think Nina Simone was the first artist who I really adopted as a kind of fellow kindred spirit. I mean, she was alive at the time. I mean, she was at the end of her career, but I knew that she was around, and I therefore gravitated towards her music. And also, my mother had experiences with her earlier when she would play Montreal a lot in her trajectory. And And my mother and I would listen to her records, and I guess it was the first time when I ever got the concept down that you could combine various types of music and therefore come up with a whole new sound, which is what she did with bringing, you know, blues and jazz and classical music and pop all together and really, molding this distinct Nina Simone aura. And so she was the one who shone the light on what I was to do later.
Did you see her live ever?
I saw her once live.
Yeah. How was
it? It wasn't, she certainly wasn't what she once was at that point, but just to be in the same room with her was incredible. She looked really angry, actually.
I think she always looked angry. Yeah. What's the song we should play of hers?
I would play Namakitapa. I love her version of Namakitapa by Jacques Brel.
Namakitapa, il faut oublier tout. S'oublier, qui s'enfuit déjà, oublier le temps des malentendus et le temps perdu, à savoir comment oublier ces heures qui tuaient parfois à coup de pourquoi le cœur du bonheur ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas. Moi, je t'enfuirai des balles de pluie venues de pays où il ne pleut pas. Je creuserai la terre jusqu'après ma mort pour couvrir ton corps d'or et de lumière. Je ferai un domaine où l'amour sera roi, où l'amour sera loi, où tu seras reine. Ne me quitte pas. 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 Je t'inventerai des mots insensés que tu comprendras. Je te parlerai de ces amants-là qui ont vu deux fois le cœur s'embraser. Je te raconterai l'histoire de ce roi mort de n'avoir pas pu te rencontrer. Ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas. On a vu souvent rejaillit le feu de l'ancien volcan qu'on croyait trop vu. Il est paru-t-il des terres brûlées dans le plus de blé qu'en meilleur avril. Et combien le soir pour qu'un ciel flamboie, le rouge et le noir ne s'épousent-ils pas. Ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas. Ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas. Ne me quitte pas, je ne vais plus pleurer, je ne vais plus parler, je me cacherai là, à te regarder, danser et sourire. À t'écouter, chanter et puis rire. Laisse-moi devenir l'ombre de ton ombre, l'ombre de ta main, l'ombre de ton chien. Ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas.
Let's talk about Maria Callas as well.
Yes.
So this is, I presume, another very early influence.
Yeah, I mean, fairly early. I mean, opera was around the house somewhat growing up, but it wasn't by no means, you know, an adored subject. my mom loved tenors. You know, she loved Pavarotti. She loved Placido Domingo. And and she knew all the Puccini arias and so forth. But for instance, they didn't know really any sopranos, and they only knew Maria Callas because she had been tabloid fodder when they were younger, and with, you know, Jackie Onassis and so forth. But then one day I became this opera fanatic.
You said, like, just one day?
One day. No, it was literally within the space of 2 hours it happened, because I listened with my mother, actually, once again, and my Aunt Anna, to Verdi's Requiem from start to finish. That was with Leontine Price and UC Björling singing. And by the end of that mass, I was a completely different person. It was a religious experience.
That's amazing.
And so I was all of a sudden this opera fanatic, and that very quickly led me to Callas. She's kind of, you know, at the forefront of that whole concept. And I, you know, immersed myself in her recordings, and they're some of the greatest recordings of all time. And when I say that, I mean, I think even if you're not an opera fan, there are certain Callas tracks that you just can't deny, on a kind of human level, are astounding for any person to be able to do that on such a high emotional level and also technical one. So Callas led me, you know, through the various halls of opera, and you know, I'm still here today.
What's the song that best? Song.
The aria.
What's the track? What's the...
You're not going to say the word aria, are you?
What's the aria that you remember first kind of feeling that moment in the chest?
I have to go... With Callas, I feel I have to go pretty traditional with her oeuvre and say Casta Diva from Norma, the opera Norma. And it's probably her most famous track. And... yeah, it's just a piece that no matter how many times you hear it, you're always touched by it, and especially her performance.
When did you first meet Anohi of Anthony the Johnsons?
Yes.
Your paths have crossed a lot of times.
I met her when she was a hymn in New York many, many years ago, when I actually, around the time of my first album. It's interesting because I had come to New York before my first album and had sort of a terrible time of it in terms of my career. Nobody really got me. Nobody understood what I was trying to do. It was during the Jeff Buckley era, when this kind of heroin, very, you know, lugubrious rock and roll thing was happening. And I was this like opera loving piano boy, and it didn't mix with New York at that time. But then I at that time, actually, I used to see Anani in productions downtown, in these, you know, arty plays. He was part of a theater troupe called Black Lips. Anyway, so I would see that. Didn't know her then. But then later, when I came back to New York with my first album, that's when everybody wanted to know me.
Thank you, at last.
Yeah. Then they were really interested and really dedicated to my, you know, well-being. And I met Anani at the Pyramid, I think, which was a club in the Lower East Side, in the East Village. And we've sung together, and she's, you know... an amazing legend in many ways, living legend. And I'm very, very happy for her success. Well, I know you're talking about artists and so forth and songs. And I mean, I was one of them I was going to bring up was Kate McGarrigle, my mother, who was obviously a great influence and was very responsible for my career in many ways. But singing the song I Cried For Us with Anani years ago for the tribute record to her after she passed was really one of the highest musical moments of my career.
Love, it's not I who didn't try hard enough. Hard enough, and this is why I'm saying goodbye. I've had enough, I've had enough. Love, you don't see the pain in me, it's plain enough.
This is the first time with me, Matt Everett, and my guest, Rufus Wainwright. And that was Rufus and Anohi with I Cried For Us from the 2013 album Sing Me the Songs, celebrating the works of Kate McGarrigle, a tribute to Rufus' mother, who died in January 2010.
Six Music. BBC Radio Six Music.
Six Music. Look at you, sucker. Does your mama know what you're doing?
at you, look at you, look at you.
I'm Matt Everett, and this is The First Time on Six Music, where we look at the key first moment in an artist's career. And my guest this week is Rufus Wainwright, and that was Rufus with the title track from his 2012 album, Out of the Game. Now, Rufus's self-titled debut album was released in 1998 and soon attracted attention for the brilliant songs and Rufus's singing, but also for the extravagance of the year-long recording sessions, which reportedly cost $700,000 and included input from acclaimed producer John Bryan and Beach Boys arranger and lyricist Van Dyke Parks. I asked him what he remembers from creating that first album.
Well, that was an interesting experience because I, believe it or not, even though I had grown up in the music business, I had no sense of how to proceed, you know, once I was signed.
Really?
Not really, no. I mean, my parents, they made great records themselves and had a lot of success and, to be honest, a lot of failure as well.
Mm-hmm.
But they never really imparted their knowledge of the way the industry worked to either of their children.
Is that
probably
good?
Because they didn't understand it so well themselves.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
What ended up happening with my first record is that I was signed to a major label. I didn't have a manager. I didn't really have a lawyer. I went with the lawyer they decided that I should have.
That's illegal,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, so I subsequently got, you know, locked up in all these insane contracts, and I went into the studio, and the producer, John Bryan, who's a wonderful producer, mm-hmm. who was also a little bit harsh with me. It took 3 years to make the record, and I was renting a car for 3 years and living in, you know, a nice hotel. So whatever, I did everything wrong. but in the end, we made a fantastic album, and I guess maybe it was also my parents' attention to just the music and only the music that, you know, gave birth to that album. Because if I had steered away and realized what was actually going on contractually and you know, with the budgets and stuff, I would have, you know, I wouldn't have made it. But it was just being dedicated to the music that made it happen in the end.
How do you feel about that record now?
I think it's a fantastic record. I mean, what's great about that record is that it's also arguably one of the last albums from a certain era where, you know, it was all done on tape. We did a lot of string sessions at Capitol Records. You know, we had Van Dyke Parks conducting the orchestra, you know, and Lenny Walker, executive producer. And it was done in a very old-fashioned way, which I don't think albums are made like that anymore, but it was one of the last gasps of that former glorious era.
Go, leave, she's better than me, or at least she is stronger. She will make it last. for the taking, but I can't say that my heart's not aching, it's breaking in two.
I can't imagine how that relationship with your family is something that's, when it becomes what you do, when you become a musician, you're surrounded by musicians and it's your parents. Parental relationships are complicated enough, let alone if you share not just a career, but a career right. that's based on expression. Was it something? Is it something that you kind of simultaneously hold very close, but also try and keep a distance from?
Probably more so with my dad.
Yeah.
Because my dad and I, though we work together often now, and we have been able to bridge many gaps. But I think this is also due a lot to the nature of the times where, you know, I and my sister were part of the real first big wave of divorce that occurred throughout the Western world. So we went through that. And, to be fair, my dad, you know, he kind of got the short end of the stick in a lot of ways because, you know, we were brought up by my mom and he was always the love of her life. And she never really got over him, and she was angry. And so there was just seated within us was this battle between our parents. And the fact that my dad wasn't around, you know, gave my mother an advantage in that department. So there was a lot of stuff I had to work out. And certainly when my artistic life came to fruition, it got very confusing because I was trying to deal with a lot of very heavy duty issues concerning my father in the arts, which is good for songwriting, but it's kind of bad for real relationships, you know? And he's equally guilty in the same sense because he writes very intensely about what he goes through personally. So I think we were both sort of, you know, shooting in the dark a little bit about in terms of what needed to happen. And eventually, you know, we just had to kind of put the songwriting aside and just, you know, deal with the issue of just being a human being.
No matter how strong, I'm gonna take you down with one little stone. I'm gonna break you down and see what you're worth.
Songwriting a kind of a therapy? If I've got a problem with something, can I reason it out by writing about it and tap into something? Or maybe if you're just writing about it and you're not actually talking about it, maybe that becomes a block in itself.
I think it's a double-edged sword and, you know, cuts both ways. And, you know, you're not going to solve the problem. You might bring it up, but then you have to actually solve it without song. No song has ever solved a problem. It's brought up a lot of problems, which are later solved, but they're not solved by the song.
Can you remember the first point when you thought, if I don't stop with my substance abuse problems, this is not going to end well for me? Was there a moment?
Probably when I pooped in my pants at the bar and didn't even... And it was like, I just took my sweater and like turned it into a sort of like mini skirt.
And, was it a nice sweater?
Yeah. And just pretended like nothing was happening. That wasn't so great.
That's a pretty strong alarm call.
Yeah. I was like, I should maybe start, you know, taking care of business here. No, there was that. There was also... Yeah, that was it. No, there was other things. I mean, I just, I think the main issue is that within all of that garbage, I always maintained a sense that I wanted to live. And I wasn't necessarily a nihilistic, self-destructive person at heart. And when I would get into these situations where I was destroying myself, I knew deep down that that really wasn't me. You know, it wasn't my bag. And so I thankfully was able to hold on to that thread and in the end, you know, whatever, reinstate my true self.
That's a nice way of putting it. Did you have any kind of musical... I mentioned this because a couple of people that I've spoken to are kind of like, yeah, there was a couple of songs that when it was really bad, I was like, if I hang on to that song, that'll help. Do you have that?
Well, I wrote a song at that time, you know, I Don't Know What It Is, which totally gave me sustenance and a direction in terms of where to go and the attitude to have on that trajectory. That was also in my Judy Garland phase, where I was listening to a lot of Judy Garland and... certain songs like, you know, The Man That Got Away or Do It Again were just, on one hand, so captivating artistically and so frightening in terms of the lengths that she went to get what she got. And
what do you mean?
Well, just, I mean, in some of those recordings and some of the power that was within her ability, which was equally... driven by talent and also by kind of like a sense of desperation. It was just very fascinating, and I could relate to it on one hand. It was like moths to a flame in a certain way, and I think her music at that time really, it kind of got me closer to the issue of addiction, but also, you know, became a cautionary tale where I don't really want to go that far. But I appreciate watching, you know, I respect her journey. And I don't think it was all for nothing, obviously, because there's these amazing recordings and performances that she gave us.
What Judy song should we play?
What Judy song? I would play... Well, just to go a little more up-tempo now, why don't we play Come Rain or Come Shine from her 1961 concert.
I'm gonna love you like nobody's loved you. Come rain or come shine. As a mountain, deep as a river, come rain or come shine. I guess when you met me, it was just one of those things, but don't ever bet me, 'cause I'm gonna be true if you let me. You're gonna love me like nobody's loved me. Come rain or come shine. Happy together, unhappy together.
you. I'm gonna love you. I'm gonna love you. I guess when you met me, it was just one of those things. But don't ever bet me, 'cause I'm gonna be true. Gonna be true if you let me. Let me, let me. Let me, let me. Let me love you. Let me love you. Come rain or come shine.
How does it feel walking out onto the stage at Carnegie Hall the first time? How does that feel?
No, it feels fantastic. It's funny, Carnegie's a bit of a, once again, a double-edged sword, because it is a great hall, unmistakably so, and I love it. But there's also, it's funny, I wouldn't say it's the warmest place in terms of its ethos. You get out there and you know that it's an important gig, but on the other hand, you know, you are on this kind of precipice, and there is a sort of fierce energy that that can derail you if you're not careful. It's unlike, for instance, I mean, I find the Albert Hall to be much more inviting. And for instance, I'm doing a Christmas show at the Ryman Auditorium in Nashville, which is an incredible hall. It's a much more mystical place. I don't find Carnegie Hall particularly a mystical place, but it's got a, there's something that always happens there. It's not an inviting place for a performer, but there's a lot of power nonetheless that emanates from there.
Yeah, I just imagine there's, I guess there's kind of things that happen in your life where your brain's kind of going, oh, this isn't a real thing that's happening. This is a dream thing that's happening, even though, but the rest of you's got to deal with the fact that it's
I mean, I did a show at Carnegie Hall once alone, just playing piano. I had that show, Songs for Lulu. I did it at Carnegie Hall where it was just me alone at the piano when nobody was allowed to applaud.
What do you mean no
that,
one?
That, no, well, I did it here. I did it at the Albert Hall too. And that was pretty amazing because then you were kind of really fighting the room in a lot of ways. But
nobody was allowed to applaud.
Nobody was allowed to applaud. After my mother died, I did a tour of piano songs and nobody was allowed to applaud the whole evening. It's pretty daring. And by addition, me of the defeated, by adding one thing to my purpose, nothing. But since she pricked me out for woman's pleasure, mine be thy love, and thy love's use their treasure. You
mentioned your child. I mean, being a father for the first time, has it changed your writing?
Well, I've written songs about her.
Yeah. Because
I don't know if it's changed my writing per se. I would say that it's definitely I mean, it's definitely changed my life.
It would be worrying if it didn't.
Yeah, it changed my life. And it's kind of what it has done, which I think is very good, is made me appreciate myself for who I am as a person, and that alone, to what I represent for this other being. You know, she doesn't care if I'm a musician or if I'm a songwriter or if I'm famous or not famous. She just wants me to be around and to be a good guy and to be fun and positive and interested, you know, in her life. So that has been a tremendous relief, and also sometimes a bit of a hard exercise, because I am so used to kind of putting Rufus the songwriter before everything. But in the end, you know, it pays off so much, because kids do remember when you actually put yourself forward and when you're actually present and real with them. They remember it and they bring it up, you know, and they. And it forms part of who they are, and you see the results of that very quickly, actually, which is wonderful.
What does she like to listen to?
Well, she loves all the Disney songs.
Haven't you been asked to write one at some point?
I did write one Disney. It was about time travel, and it was a flop. and it wasn't my fault, but it was called Meet the Robinsons, right. She especially loves Aladdin. And the music to that, I can't stand one bit. But there's a song like A Whole New World.
Yeah.
There's a whole new world. And she listens to it over and over and over again. And I kind of allow that. You know, then once it's over, and I'm very relieved. But then, of course, the other day I was, you know, on a plane, and my phone was on shuffle, and all of a sudden it went to, like, A Whole New World song. And I was like, oh, I love this song. And it is a whole new world, so...
So we shouldn't play the whole of that track at this point.
No.
Of the show.
Please.
And the final thing. I need you to pick the final song that we should play.
The final song. Well, you know, we did talk a lot about my mom, so I figure why not do one for Dad? Because he is great, too. So I will be a good child and respect both my parents, and we could do his song about me, Rufus is a Tit Man.
And that's what we'll finish in. It's been a pleasure to speak to you. Thank you.
Rufus is a tit man. He's sucking on his mama's band. He's sucking on the nipple. It's a sweeter than the ripple wine. Yes, it's sweeter than the wine. You can tell by the way the boy burps that it's got a taste fine. Hey, Marco Polo, crepe the spice and silk and Rufus crepes for mama's milk. No milk cow, no billy goat is gonna get the baby's vote. Come on, mama. Come on and open up your shirt. Yeah, you got the goods, mama. Give the little boy a squirt. Suck on cigarettes and drink the wine and beer. The doctor says I'm oral, and I believe it's true. I believe it's true. Hey son, you look so satisfied. I envy you. I put Rufus on the left one and put me right on the right, and like Romulus and Remus, well, suck on. Thank you.
Six music.
This morning from 11, Huey Morgan.
At 8, Radcliffe and Marconi.
Right now.
It's Chris Hawkins.